You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maad, and this is Season 2, Episode 2. Sam Anderson is back. We got Sam back on the Zoom. And not only does Sam have even more cliches for you, but we unlocked together the key to success in life. And we share that key with you at some point during the conversation. Can't tell you when. You got to listen to the whole dang thing. But it's in there. Believe me. This is the follow-up episode to episode one with Sam. If you haven't listened to that, go do that and then come back here. I also just want to sneak in a little plug here, if you'll let me. This podcast and really most of my work out there in the world is available for free, and that is made possible by my Special Projects membership program. So if you dig this pod and you want to see more pods like this in the world, consider joining at craigmaad.com/membership. Thank you. As for this episode, it was recorded 10 months after the first one in January 2021, and Sam and I are reflecting on the weirdness and the stresses of those intervening months, because they were heady. Just to give some context, in case you are living in a bunker civilization sometime in the future, which, to be quite honest, does not seem that far-fetched to those of us living today in 2021. In 2020, the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic just refused to let up. It got worse and worse and worse. The U.S. was fumbling with vaccinations. Brexit finally happened over in Europe. Just weeks before our recording of this episode, the U.S. Capitol was attacked by a mob. And then soon after, in a move reminiscent of locusts or frogs falling from the sky or blood raining down upon humanity, in what can only be considered a clear portention of the impending end of the world, GameStop. Yes, GameStop, the favorite mall shop of time travelers to 1992, had one of the biggest, yes, biggest, craziest pops in the history of the U.S. stock market. Unfortunately, we live in interesting times, but I believe Sam and I are hopeful. And Sam was, he was a pretty productive writer in 2020. We dig into what it was like to shadow Weird Al Yankovic, what life was like inside the NBA bubble, how to smuggle a personal essay into bigger reporting pieces. Sam even sneaks in a few hard burns on Florida. And we talk about why describing a snowball fight in 19th century France is a perfect literary exercise. We hope you enjoy the chat.
Yeti stereo microphone quality, a maximum.
Test, 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 test.
And it's recording and it sounds like it's going and everything's right. I don't know if we have anything else to talk about, to be perfectly honest. We kind of covered all of life. I guess the world changed around us in the meantime, huh?
And with that, hello, Sam.
Hey, Craig. You said in the intro that it's been 18 months. Is that right?
Yeah, in the intro of the first of our two-part mega interview series, I said it's been 18 months since I've released properly an episode of this pod on Margins. It mainly just speaks to the pain of editing these things, which was where you have these kind of waveforms and you're in like audition and you just see these squiggles. And quite frankly, it's just not fun. It's pretty painful. So this new software that I got, which I'm not being sponsored by, but I would take a sponsorship from them because it's kind of expensive. It's pretty amazing. It's called Descript, and it sort of uses, I don't know, like what a machine learning, what is all software used these days? Machine learning, AI. It uses some voodoo and it turns all the waveforms into text, and you can just edit the words and delete things, and stuff is deleted. So like last time I deleted approximately 14,000 ums from your side of the recording, and it was pretty easy.
This is the second time you've burned me on my use of ums. Did you not? I thought you were going to be like, from both of our recordings, because we're normal humans who speak.
I was really paying attention, and I was pretty proud of myself. I have all these other horrible verbal tics, like not actually finishing a thought. And jumping around a bit, but there were a lot of ums on your side, but anyway. So why don't we catch everyone up? That first episode of us chatting was recorded on March 22nd, 2020, right when we had just entered the lockdown, and that just felt crazy. Like, we're in a lockdown. That's crazy.
There was like a real mellow, dragging, depressed vibe to that conversation, which I actually really enjoyed
right,
hearing.
Right.
But it was also, it was notable. Like, you could listen to that conversation on 1.5 speed and it would just sound like a normal, real normal human conversation. You'd be like, oh, those guys are really taking their time expressing themselves. I remember once I said the word literature and it took like 8 seconds, I think.
You know, it was slow because, you know, in March of last year, we were sort of like, well, we're at the beginning of this and it's going to take, you know, a month or two. And that felt, you know, kind of weird. Like, what, a month? Really? We're going to have to be in this locked out state for like 2 months?
Yeah. And then there was those like Armageddon predictions where it was like, no, this could last through June. And we were like, no, that's, come on. And then you began to see that that was actually the case. And then you had this like sci-fi thought that was like, what if this lasted until like September? And then it was just all like the most ridiculous, really like fantastical notion. And then it did it. And then here we are in January. And I feel like life might get back to normal in the fall. I feel like, or sort of normal in the fall. I feel like the pandemic will lift a little bit in the summer as it did last year, and then maybe we won't come crashing down. It won't ramp back up in the fall like it did. What do you think?
I think that's a pretty optimistic and generous take for sure.
Yeah. You think we're in it through next winter?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to sound like some kind of insane doomsday, you know, predictor, but, you know, my plan right now, it's January 2021, and I don't plan on going anywhere outside of Japan until spring of 2022 at the earliest. So I assume at least 14 more, 15 more months of not being able to do easy international travel. And, you know, things like the Olympics just feel completely impossible. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you logistically handle this. My heart goes out to these athletes who have been training since the beginning of their lives, and these things keep getting pushed out. But even if you just think about the Tokyo Olympics in the context of hosting only the athletes, like that alone is something like 100,000 people with like all of the athletes and all of their trainers and their help and everything like that. And I don't know. I just think that having that ready for July/August, it feels really, really like a big ask, especially considering people fly in from almost every country in the world. So in order to keep myself sane, I think part of what's important about maintaining sanity is rational expectations. And I'm just kind of saying to myself, well, I'm still kind of, we're just going to be kind of like in one place, at least for the next year. And that if we somehow have this magical ability to overcome things easily this year, then great. That's just like a bonus. But, you know, my plan is kind of, you got to chill out. But, you know, that said, you had a really productive 2020.
Yeah, I had a pretty productive 2020. Sure. Yeah, I did. I mean, some of it was just clearing out backlog, which we talked about in that old episode. How many stories I was sitting on. I remember saying I was like sitting on so many stories that should be the best thing I've ever written. One of those was the story of the last two northern white rhinos, which was just recently published. Oh, and another one was the profile of Weird Al Yankovic, which came out in April, I think. So after we spoke.
Yeah, that came out in April. And I just went back over all this stuff you were working on, and you had Weird Al, and you had the NBA bubble, and you had the rhinos, basically.
Yeah, those were my big features. And then I had a couple little things that kind of hit and got a lot of attention and made people happy, which were I wrote a little Screenland column, which is an analysis of some video that's circulating on the web about this 1897 film of French people throwing snowballs at each other that had been digitally smoothed and all the things we can do and colorized and everything and went viral. And so I wrote this sort of play-by-play analysis of the French snowball fight, which was really fun. And that was an interesting assignment because it's a column that runs every week in the magazine Screenland. And this one was a weird one because it was going to be written and completely closed before the U.S. presidential election, and then it would be published immediately after the presidential election. And so they were like, you really have to, we need a special subject that really sort of threads the needle and feels relevant without being tied to any particular political outcome that everyone is going to be talking about. So I came up somehow with this old timey French snowball fight, and it was really fun to write. And it got a big response online. I said, because I think it came out the day after the election. And I said to my editor, well, I mean, I think it's pretty good, but no, literally not a human soul is going to read this thing. And then she texted me later in the day and said, it's the number one most read thing on the New York Times right now.
Wow.
Which, yeah, I think they included little like GIFs, little looping GIFs that were actually on the homepage of the New York Times. So you could see the French people pelting each other as you're scrolling down. And I think that was sort of irresistible for people to click.
Yeah. I mean, anything last year that was like a blip of joy, you know, of the moment, I think that was irresistible. Anything that got us, you know, away from the crippling reality in front of our eyes.
Right, right. It had a very clickbaity headline. It was something like, watch this 1897 snowball fight for a pure jolt of joy or something. Yeah. Sometimes the editors give you that little gift.
Well, it was this funny thing because it's just describing very accurately something that's visual that you're just looking at. And it's so much harder to do than it sounds.
It's such a fun exercise. I love doing it. I love writing text that goes next to photo essays. And I did this a lot in Boomtown, my book that we discussed. I did a lot of just watching basketball plays and just, you know, you've got like a 30-second clip of some incredibly dramatic, decisive moment on which a whole civic destiny turns. And you sit down and watch it and you're like, oh yeah, that stuff happened. And then just to break it down into speech and articulate what's going on and where the energy of the clip really is in a way that somehow verbally captures that energy and shoots it off to whoever is going to be reading it. It's a really fun, weird challenge. And I kind of love doing it. And it's just by watching the clip 100 times in a row, you just notice so many things that, you know, casually watching it, you'd never see. It's really fun.
Well, and I kind of had this experience in November firsthand with the work that I was doing. So for folks on here that don't follow my work, in November, I was doing this big walk across Japan, 700 kilometers. And my buddy, John McBride, had written kind of like a guidebook talking about the ancient road that I was walking on. And in this guidebook, there were prints of like all of the post towns that I was walking through. And there were these woodblock prints by Hiroshige. And the chapters in the guidebook all began with these kind of like really specific re-descriptions of what you were looking at in the print. And at first I was sort of like, this is kind of weird. Why, you know, you can just see all this stuff, you're looking at it. It felt kind of like almost like Braille or something was being added to the print, to the guidebook. But the more I read, the more I realized that a really accurate description of a thing that you're looking at is so valuable, and it starts to reveal all of these other layers and richness of like cultural action or, you know, strange signaling that you would miss otherwise if you were just looking at the image. And, you know, a lot of times you don't look deeply or at the details of an image, you kind of scan over it. And so while probably a bunch of people saw that French snowball fight, you know, it kind of made the rounds as a viral video, your description of it was so accurate and funny and kind of entertaining and compassionate that I think many people probably saw it, you know, again, as they say, for sort of like the first time. And it's literally just that act of describing that is so powerful. And it's actually a really good writing hack. Like if you're stuck and words aren't flowing for you, just pick a piece of art that you're interested in. Pick a photograph, pick a scene from a film, you know, and freeze the frame and just start writing out what you're seeing in the most accurate way you possibly can muster.
Absolutely. That's a great writing hack. Yeah, words are magic. Words are really magic. They add so much. You can take a TikTok video, right? And you think the TikTok video is the end in itself. Like, you don't need any gloss on that, but you absolutely do. It's so much funnier if you can articulate what is like embarrassing or weird or impressive about what that person is doing. That is a great hack. Like, if you're stuck on something, especially if you're trying to do like a project, yeah, just put a picture of your subject in front of you and just sit down and say, okay, describe visually this person for someone who has no idea who they are. Or watch this 10-second clip and just write down what happens. And in writing down the details, you start to understand what's so interesting about it.
Well, and I think the part of the trick of being successful is to bring compassion to that description. You know, it's like you don't sort of pick something and then kind of just rip it apart and sort of, you know, say how horrible it is or how, you know, how disgusting something is or whatever. George Saunders, in a lot of his interviews, brings up this idea of asking the question, and then what? And then what? Why? And why? Why did the character feel this way? Okay, and then why did they feel that way? And why? Okay, and so what led to that? And there's this sort of digging process of observation, you know, where you're looking at more and more granular detail about a person or a place. And the more you do that, the easier it is to kind of construct this empathy around the subject. And I think that's where you find pretty incredible, you know, writing. And that's where work that really moves you, I think, comes from. At least personally, that's what I've found to be a pretty common pattern. You know, I think that's especially true in profiles of folks. And I think you've done a great job of that in a lot of your profiles. Even this morning, I was rereading that Weird Al profile, and there were just details and moments in that profile where, you know, I was eating my eggs and I just started crying.
You cried?
Yeah. I mean, it was, there's something about the kindness of what was coming out in that profile that was just so moving to me.
Weird Al was supposed to be the cover story back in April 2020. And that just became impossible, especially given the art that the brilliant photo people at the Times Magazine had worked so hard. My colleague Amy Kellner worked for weeks and weeks and weeks and months and months and months to set up this bananas photo shoot of Weird Al standing in front of, I think it was like 250, maybe hundreds of people dressed up like Weird Al, like sort of vintage 1980s Weird Al with wigs and everything and fake mustaches and big glasses. And this was just the most crushingly difficult logistical challenge of anyone's life to make this thing happen. And she made it happen. And that was going to be the big cover shoot. And everyone was holding these signs that said, like, it's a weird, weird, weird world. And it was going to be the coolest cover ever. And then COVID hit and crowds became toxic. And people wearing Hawaiian shirts talking about how weird things were became not so funny. And so it ran inside the magazine. It wasn't the big cover we hoped for. But I think it did resonate on a different level in that time in April 2020. And I think it touched people in a way that it probably wouldn't have in normal life. So I think I played up that strand of Weird Al as a kid, total nerd, socially awkward, bullied forever, super smart, and just trapped by himself in this tiny room that became his whole world. I think I really played up that people yearning for connection trapped in tiny rooms thread.
Well, and your description of that show to me really kind of hit home it got to the core of what can be so crushing about this extended isolation. Because you wrote about that show, you wrote, Weird Al had pulled off a strange emotional trick. He had brought the isolated energy of all our tiny rooms into this one big public space. When he left stage, we stopped for more, and he came back out and played Yoda, his classic revision of the Kinks' Lola. And then he left again, and I decided that this was the single best performance of any kind that I had ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it was transcendent. It was so great. I remember I had a plus one, and I remember thinking about inviting Jake Silverstein, the editor-in-chief of the magazine, who was a big skeptic about me writing a big profile of Weird Al Yankovic. Because why? Because this guy was huge in the 80s and has kind of had a couple of blips of popularity since then. But why now? Who needs a profile of Weird Al? And I thought about inviting Jake because I'd heard Weird Al was great in concert. And then I thought that could be the world's biggest disaster, where Weird Al, you know, hobbles out as a 59-year-old man and plays this kind of warmed over set of old parodies, and the energy is bad. And Jake is like, I'm sorry, this piece is canceled, or, you know, it's 1,000 words long. So I didn't invite him. I brought my daughter instead. But at the end of the night, we were just flying high. We could not believe what we had seen. I mean, when the world reopens, I will see Weird Al in every tour that he does from now on for the rest of my life.
Well, and I think also what was making me emotional about the Weird Al piece is just, it felt sort of like no matter how you sliced him, he was kind of undeniably a force for good.
I do agree with that. Yeah. I think he is a deeply good, thoughtful, beautiful hearted man. I mean, he has human complexities like everybody, but I think he goes so far out of his way to be kind to everyone around him. It's pretty amazing. And the force behind his music is this celestial kindness behind all the silly goofiness. So yeah, for sure.
Something I wanted to read a little bit more about in the piece was his self-protection sort of methods that he used on the tour bus.
Yeah, he's a really interesting character in that, you know, the little boy isolated in his bedroom that he was dying to get out of and connect with the world. You know, he's still that little boy isolated in his bedroom in the back of the tour bus. And in some ways, I think that's his comfort zone, is being alone and being quiet and binging TV shows and reading every comment about him on the internet. He has something like 5.2 million Twitter followers, and he reads every Twitter mention.
Really?
Yeah, I was like, that sounds pretty crazy. And he's like, yeah, it's crazy, but I do it. He said, I don't really respond because that just opens a can of worms where who do I respond to and who do I not respond to? But I read them all. Yeah.
That is that's something I would recommend to nobody ever.
No. I think it's deeply unhealthy, probably, especially when you're a public figure and there's just so much shit flying around. Although it may be that this may be true, that just what he puts out in the world is such a radiating positivity that that's pretty much what he gets back. I think they're probably extremely nice mentions.
Well, the thing that struck me as an introvert myself is that I totally understand that need to recharge, and I totally get that sense of like, I need to protect my life force in order to be present and fully there on stage. That makes so much sense to me. And I was just a little more curious about how he navigates like messaging of that to everyone, or if it's just canon and everyone knows, okay, we're on the bus, leave Al alone, just don't mess with him between shows.
It's canon. Yeah. Everybody knows. And yeah. And he has communicated that over the decades in the friendliest possible way. It's just very matter of fact. always very polite to whoever comes up to him, but everybody knows he would prefer not to be disturbed. And he's also one of those guys who has surrounded himself with people he just trusts deeply and who like get him and get his project. So, I mean, he's had the same band members since the early 80s, and he's only ever had one manager.
Well, and I think too, you know, kind of what was striking in rereading the piece now is that there's kind of this purity, which in the last couple of years, this sense of pure intention and goodness has only kind of become amplified. My radar for picking up on it has become amplified because of, you know, what's been going on in the world. And there definitely feels like this element, not to over psychoanalyze or whatever, but of Al doing all of this work to bring joy to a childhood version of himself, you know, when he was like 10 or 11 in his bedroom. And there's something really, I think, incredible about that impulse. And I found this morning thinking about this weird parallel between Weird Al and Mr. Rogers that I had never thought about before.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. There's a sort of saintliness and a monastic kind of devotion to this very improbable artistic enterprise with a deep morality at its heart. And they're both extremely white. I mean, they're just like extremely white cultural products of white America.
It's true. Yeah. It's true.
Yeah, there's a real parallel between those two. And they both turned what could easily have been, you know, faults or whatever into like the nuclear core of their career and talent and connection to the world. And Mr. Rogers, I've never seen it adequately explored. What a weirdo that guy was, you know? There was that documentary about him that everybody loved, and I came away a little bit disappointed by it because I thought it might get a little bit deeper into... Did you see that documentary? Yeah, the one where he revealed that he weighs himself every single day and he's always exactly the same weight.
Right.
And he loves it because it's like... It's whatever it is, there's some numerology involved. His weight translates to the letters I L Y, which stands for I love you, right? It was something like that. That just suggests a whole like deep archaeology, psychogeography that could have been excavated, but I don't know. But I mean, and that was like the theme of the Weird Al piece was we're all a bunch of ridiculous weirdos, you know, who are all warped in various ways around whatever childhood problems we had to deal with and all this violence that was done to us by the world. And, you know, some of us are more charmed than others, but we're all damaged in various ways. And it makes us all vulnerable weirdos. And if that's something that we can connect over, then that is such a powerful thing, because that goes so deep in everybody. Even the president of the United States is not a perfectly balanced, normal person.
Well, we could circle back to that in a second, but one thing that was also interesting about that Weird Al piece is that you inject quite a bit of yourself into it. And I'm curious, like, when did that enter the writing process? Was there an early draft that sort of personal history entered into, or was that something you felt you needed to add later on, that bit about, you know, your own kind of weirdness and struggles?
My bedwetting?
Yeah, the bedwetting and...
Yeah, that felt very natural. Yeah, I feel like I'm always just trying to smuggle a personal essay into everything that I write, whether it's a book review or really anything, a profile of someone else, because that's, you know, the engine of my interests in the world is what I've gone through. And so I feel like the form of the personal essay does a really cool thing where you can get so particular about yourself, and then somehow you get so particular that you bounce out the other side and it becomes totally universal. And I love that. And I love doing that. So there's really, yeah. So nothing that's happened in your life is meaningless or is wasted. You can always write about it in a way that somebody else will identify with. And it just feels really cool. So that felt, yeah, that felt really natural to do in the Weird Al piece. And in a way, it was like the strategy for, I don't know, answering the skepticism of someone like Jake Silverstein, who was like, why are we writing about Weird Al? And that's just one way of answering that question. Like, this is why we're writing about Weird Al, because it goes this deep in me and in all these other people too.
Right. So was that there from an early draft? Do you remember when?
I think it was. I think there was that line. The section starts, once upon a time, there was a boy who wet his bed. And I think that line just was one of those that just kind of fell from the ceiling, and I had it. And I knew that was a section. Weird Al wrote me a very funny note, a really wonderful, lovely note. I mean, an hour after the piece came out or something. I think he stayed up all night waiting for the piece to come out online and read it, and wrote me a really wonderful email. And one of the things he said was like, I was just so relieved to find out that the boy who wet his bed was not me. He read the beginning of that section. I'm like, oh my God, where is this going?
Yeah. I mean, even the second time through, I was sort of like, wait, was this Sam or was this Al? You know, you don't reveal it until a few paragraphs in, but I could see how Al would have been worried about you finding some secret about him that he didn't even know himself. And how old were you while all that was happening, while the peeing was happening?
I want to say like 10, 11 or something like that. I think maybe 9. I have kind of a hazy memory of the specifics of it, but I just remember it was a haunting thing that it's like, there's this very particular feeling of essentially like committing a crime while you are unconscious, you know? And I can still feel it sometimes when this will go in the TMI file of this podcast, Cutting Room Floor. But like when I'm going pee in a normal way, there's this like weird psychic overlap that sometimes can happen where just the sensation of it, I can suddenly feel that childhood feeling of like, oh no, I'm going in my pants. And I can just feel exactly what that feels like. And I have to sort of remind myself like, no, I'm just a grown up guy. I'm just going in this urinal over here. It's fine. That's still in there psychically. And it's like, that sucks to wake up and realize that you've done something, you know, that feels when you're a kid, that just feels horrible and shameful. And, you know, it's a bummer. And there's no volition.
Yeah. Ugh. I mean, in a weird way, like this whole pandemic and the lockdown kind of feels like a global bedwetting in the sense like this is also not of our volition either. You know, it's just this horrible situation we keep waking up in. And, you know, we're still locked down now. And in the middle of last year's ongoing pandemic, the NBA ran their little bubble in Disney World.
Right.
And it was successful. And you went and lived in that bubble for 2 weeks.
2 weeks, yeah.
And man, you got some pretty good hard burns on Florida at the beginning of that piece.
Did I? I'm always burning Florida. My brother lives there, and I'm always just like, this place is trash. This place is just like every bad human instinct, every bad thing about America and urban planning. It just went wild in Florida, and it's disgusting. Fix it. Oh, humans shouldn't even be there. I mean, humans in modern American form with this like rigid concrete infrastructure should just not be in Florida. Anyway, so yeah, I have some burns about Florida. I mean, how could you not? It's Disney World. It's one of the most absurd, sort of unforgivable blights on the earth, ecologically. Oh, God. Economically, you know, it's Disney World.
Yeah, I mean, Disney World in my mind is known as the Chernobyl of the South. So it's, come on, it's not that bad.
The infrastructure, the waste, it's awful. It's like truly the worst of America. just in terms of treating the environment and like the prioritization of resources and land use and everything. I mean, it's indefensible. And as an American, I love it. Like, we go there with my family. My children love it. They keep saying one of their refrains over the last year has just been like, oh, I really want to go to Disney World. I wish we could go to Disney World, because we go there, I don't know, once every couple of years or something. Somehow that happened. And I remember my very first trip, walking in as like this sour, you know, New York intellectual in like a black turtleneck, metaphorically smoking a French cigarette or something, and is ready to be so disgusted. Yeah, exactly. And instead, I was completely disarmed by the power of corporate capitalism and just loved it. I mean, it was just like, it's irresistibly great. If you're in the Disney World bubble, I mean, it's like a great American bubble, even in regular times. If you're in there and you're in a receptive American state of mind, consumerist state of mind, and you can just let all that other stuff that I was just ranting about go, which they make it very easy to do, then it's so fun and so wonderful. And we have such a great time. And I hate it. Like, on a deeper level, I hate it. And I love it so much. I mean, it's a perfect American thing. It's just, that's just what it means to live in a culture and to be an American and to be a critical thinker as well. Yeah, that place shouldn't exist. What they've done to the native habitat, the swamps, I mean, it's awful. The water. Anyway, so I went to the NBA bubble. I mean, yeah, the burns on Florida are just like very, they come from deep within me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're also kind of layups, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's an easy place to burn.
Not to harp on the burns on the intro, but what I thought was nice about that introduction and what you captured, and perhaps maybe will be one of the bits that when we look back on this moment, maybe we understand how intense the feeling was, but like your image that you paint of yourself, where you're sitting there with two masks on and you've Clorox disinfected all the surfaces and the windows are down, and you know, the heat and the disgustingness of Florida is flying in and trying to wash off the virus. It feels now maybe like a little bit overly paranoid, in the sense of I think we have a better understanding of how the virus works, and that, you know, it's about viral load versus exposure time. And like, really, I think in that environment of kind of like a car with all the windows open, like you'd be fine. Like, you probably didn't need to have your masks on or whatever. But I do think, you know, it's as a kind of like anthropological bit of history, it's a fascinating part of that introduction.
Yeah. I had a whole protocol sheet from the New York Times that told me to do all that stuff. So I just did it. And my wife could not believe I was going on this bubble trip. And I kind of just said, well, it's literally a once in a lifetime.
Hopefully just once.
Hopefully. I mean, it'll always be the first. So in that sense, once in a lifetime. And I'll take every precaution and et cetera, et cetera. So I did it. But yeah, it was pretty freaky. And then the disjunction between all of that and driving into Disney World, driving through the cheerful arch welcoming me to Disney World, that, again, I've driven through so many times with my family on some of the most fun trips we've ever had. That kind of whiplash was pretty intense. And then living this completely bizarre, isolated hotel room life, quarantining in this luxury hotel on a golf course, and then getting out of that and riding this bus to watch NBA players play in tiny, tiny weird arenas that were a 2-minute walk. You know, you watch one game, all these superstars, and then you walk 2 minutes and go tip off at another game with all these other NBA superstars. And it was just it was wild.
Considering you're such a big fan of the NBA, was it kind of like a in some ways a dream experience, like a really surreal dream experience to have that density of talent all right there. You know, like how many games a day were you watching? 3, 4, 5 games?
4 games a day. Yeah. And it was really, I mean, yes, the spectacle of it, like the talent and intelligence and everything, you know, you can love about a professional sport on display was so amazing and fun to watch. And then very quickly, it just became like eating 500 cakes in a row. And it's like you're eating cake for every meal. Like, when I'm still doing this, I was so happy when I left. Yeah, I started going really crazy in the bubble. I mean, time just got all disjointed. I mean, it was kind of a more extreme version of what everyone was going through in their own little bubbles, just with this parade of NBA stuff happening in front of me.
How long were the players in the bubble?
They were there. I mean, the ones, so the Lakers who won the championship were in the bubble for like 3 months. Something like that, like July, August, I think end of July, all of August, September, and part of October. So yeah, probably three-ish months. They were living in a little bit different circumstances than me, but by all accounts, it was just completely alienating for everybody and just emotionally draining. I've never been more exhausted. All the stupid reporting trips I've ever done, all the extreme thing, you know, the 20-mile walk in Oklahoma City and the whatever, all the dumb things I've done where I just stay up multiple days, and I've never been more exhausted than I was on this bubble trip, just sitting in the darkness at the edge of an arena, watching these brightly lit games one after the other, after the other, after the other, and going back to my hotel room at midnight. It was bizarre. It was bizarre. I mean, and fan, I wouldn't say I'm really a huge NBA fan. I am a fan of the Portland Trail Blazers. So those games were special. Those games, I was like weird little boy. A weird little middle-aged boy with a big beard jumping up and down, like trying to look professional. And then there was like 5 of us watching the game, and I was like, and so that part was actually really fun. I got to kind of just be an excited little kid. Yeah, but I never want to do that again. I was so relieved. And then every time we watched a game, so my son is kind of getting into basketball. He's 13 now. And when I came home, we would turn a game on and they would show the exterior shot of this bizarre abandoned sports complex in the middle of Disney World where the arenas were. And I'd be like, that's where I would walk out of the bus and go to eat a Mickey bar between games. And I just had this powerful sense of relief. I'm so glad I'm not in the bubble anymore. I still feel that. I'm so glad I'm in this closet and not in that freaking NBA bubble right now.
But like creatively, last year, you know, we started talking in March right after the lockdown happened. And we were kind of talking about that weird dilation of time and like not knowing if we should change our pajamas or not. And like, you know, your kids weren't going to school. And like, what does anything mean in the world anymore?
That conversation felt novel in that moment.
No, it did. It felt like we had just discovered, you know, the double helix or something. And so what was your experience in the end last year creatively? Like, how long did it take you to dig into a schedule and to start getting work done properly? And like, what was that vibe like of your working process in the middle of everything last year?
It was a real struggle early on. I got very depressed, I would say in April. And I was actually supposed to be writing the big introductory essay in a special issue the magazine was doing about the pandemic and about quarantine. And I had this vision, I had this really grandiose vision that I was going to write this like defining cultural criticism portrait of America in quarantine. And it would be like that crazy book Within the Context of No Context, but it would be about... Have you read that? It's a really good little slim little book that ran in the New Yorker in the 80s or 90s. So I wanted to write something like that. And I started writing all these big thoughts and nothing that I wrote was working. and I was having a lot of trouble focusing. I was not exercising. I was eating really gross, bad food. I was eating a lot of chips, and I couldn't get any essayistic strands to cohere. And my wonderful editor, Sasha, was just like, yeah, this is not working at all. Like, I was like, okay, I'll work on it in a couple more days. I'll take it in a different direction. I'd send it in. She'd be like, none of this is working in any way. And it was shocking and terrible. And it was one of the worst writing experiences I've ever had. And I've had like a real Mount Rushmore of bad writing experiences, but this topped them all. And so it got to closing week. The whole issue was closing, and everyone else had managed to write their essays. And I was supposed to write this signature huge essay at the beginning, and nothing was working. I couldn't make it happen. I was playing a lot of Animal Crossing, and finally I threw everything away on like Tuesday of closing week, which is just obscene and not done. And I was like, I'm going to write a completely new thing. And Sasha and I kind of talked it through, and I hit on this idea of the cocoon. And I started writing about cocoons. And then I started looking at the very hungry caterpillar and thinking about eating chips and all that stuff. And I ended up writing this modest little essay about cocoons and what happens to caterpillars inside cocoons. I remember that was the thought. I was like, I need like a central metaphor here. And I was thinking about actually hibernating turtles, which I know is something I talked about in our previous conversation about how I have this ability to sort of dive into the mud at the bottom of a pond and stay there for months or years and turtle away from the world. And so I was going to write about that in the context of quarantine. And then somehow I started thinking about caterpillars, and it occurred to me that I had no idea what happens to a caterpillar inside a cocoon. Like, is it a magical, wonderful process? Or maybe it's different than how I imagine it. You imagine like it starts filling up with glitter, and then it starts sparkling, and then the wings grow, and then it's all very beautiful. And so I just kind of started Googling around and doing some reading about what actually happens. And it turns out it's quite disgusting and horrible. And perfect for my writing purposes about quarantine. So I wrote this whole essay about cocoons and the destruction of caterpillars and metamorphosis. And I think it turned out pretty well. I got a lot of really great feedback on that piece. But that piece, I mean, cocoon-like, it came out of the horrible melting destruction of me as a writer, and that I failure to write anything that would work for the magazine.
When you say you were going back and forth with your editor, and they were like, hey man, Sam, we love you, but this kind of just isn't working, like, what were you trying and what was failing about it? What wasn't quite cohering?
I think part of what I was doing was I think I was making an argument for incoherence. I was like, we live in an incoherent time right now, and it's like I can't pretend to write something that coheres. And so I'm going to write this thing in a lot of different pieces that will sort of add up to something about our time. So it was a bit of an experimental weirdo thing I was trying, and it just wasn't doing the adding up. I remember I was really into this image of I was really into the idea of how like it was hard to know. There were no like stable surfaces anymore. Surfaces were sort of melting off each other, and you didn't know. It was, everyone just felt very displaced. I remember I was really into this metaphor of like one of the signature feelings of early quarantine to me was, of course, the hand washing, which we were doing all the time, scrubbing in like doctors whenever we touched anything. And so then your hands were like raw and sometimes bleeding. And so then you'd put lotion on your hands. And then, of course, 3 minutes later, you'd go to wash your hands again. And that feeling of washing your hands with soap while you still had lotion that had yet to be fully absorbed into your skin, and this like sliding over sliding and not being able to like find what, you know, that I really liked that image. So I was trying stuff with that. And I was writing about Animal Crossing, and I was Tiger King, I think, all the early quarantine stuff. and it just wasn't adding up, or it just wasn't doing it. And so, you know, in the end, I wrote a much more traditional little essay with a much tighter focus. One funny thing is that as a framing device, the narrator of my big sprawling quarantine essay, the essay started with me inviting the reader to sit down and binge and stress eat a bag of chips with me. And it was this kind of, like second person sort of, oh, hello there, you know, join me, have a seat, let's stress eat some chips together. And that became this kind of set piece that I ended up throwing away and never thinking about again. But one of the editors at the magazine, Bill Wasik, was like, I really love this chip stuff, and I think we should use it sometime down the road. And so I didn't even do anything. I forgot about it. And then many, many months later, like in December, I got an email that was like, hey, we edited this thing that you wrote about chips into something to run in the letter of recommendation column in the magazine. I said, great. Letter of recommendation, eating chips. So that was the narrative voice of my quarantine essay that just got rescued and run as a letter of recommendation just about eating chips. And people kind of went crazy for that. And it got many, many hundreds of comments online. And everyone emailed me about their favorite chip.
Oh, that's interesting to reframe that piece as something that came out just a few weeks into the pandemic. Because in my mind, you know, just having it just come out recently, it feels like a late pandemic stage piece.
Nope. That was that was April, I think. That was me being depressed and sitting around eating a lot of chips and trying to kind of write my way out of it. And I wrote all that in my journal as just like a flyer, just like a free writing exercise, and typed it up and polished it up and whatever. And that ended up coming out, yeah, at the end of the year.
No, I mean, it's great. The whole thing is hilarious. And really, what seals it for me is the title, where it's just called, I Recommend Eating Chips.
It's so stupid. I love that letter of recommendation column, which was actually my wife's idea and has been a huge success in the magazine.
Well, but what else have you recommended?
I have recommended, yeah, I love kind of messing with the form, messing with the boundaries of what can be recommended. Because I wrote a previous one that was, I recommend looking out the window. And it's all about looking out the window, and it turns into this little vignette about this time I fell asleep in my chair in my office and woke up to a loud crash and looked out the window and saw a guy had just crashed his car into a fence across the street. And then I watched this whole weird human drama unfold where he appeared to be just driving away and leaving this fence in shambles, but he actually ended up parking his car and like rebuilding the fence in like improving the fence. It was really amazing. It was just the worst, crappiest like chain link fence. And he went and rebuilt it and like reinforced it with other parts. And it was really a triumph of the human spirit. So I wrote this essay on recommending looking out the window. And I wrote one, the kickoff column for the letter of recommendation column in the magazine. And it was recommending Tusk, the album by Fleetwood Mac, their 1979 double album Tusk, the one that came out after Rumors. So that was my first letter of rec. But I've written a whole bunch of them. I did one about blind drawing.
And you said you got a lot of comments on that piece, a lot of positive kind of feedback. I think the humor and what you're getting at writing about in this chips instance, this kind of shameful thing that probably a lot of us in the pandemic are doing. I definitely ate some boxes of like crackers and whatever, like kind of in a fury in ways that I wouldn't normally do. These are things that people don't go on Twitter and proclaim. And so to kind of have, you know, the New York Times put that up on their front page is a kind of weird, powerful permission to not be ashamed of the thing. And in fact, to kind of embrace it.
Yeah, I think so. It's so funny too, because the week before that chips thing came out, I published one of my big long features about these two rhinos, It's like an 8,000 word feature that took me over a year to finish writing and involved a trip to Kenya for a week and a million interviews and just all the things that kind of story involves. And then this stupid chips thing came out the week following and got like more comments and, you know, it just felt like it got as much attention or more. And it just made me think about who I am and what I do. And I was like, you know how many essays I could write that are just like eating chips that are just like, I don't know, anything. I could write hundreds, thousands of these essays. And maybe that's what I should, maybe I should be doing that more. Because, I mean, it's fun. I love personal essays like that. I love writing about, again, it's like what we were saying earlier. I love articulating just normal, trivial things and heightening them a little bit into sort of like almost a prose poem about eating chips. I mean, that is this tradition of writing that I really, really love. So maybe I should be doing more of that.
That to me sounds like a Substack, sounds like a newsletter in the making there, Sam.
Yeah. I feel like I missed that wave.
I don't know. That's kind of what people who are...
Okay, here we go. Here comes a burn. Here comes a burn. What kind of people say that, Craig? Tell me who I am.
You know who says that?
Who?
Who says that? Losers say that, Sam.
Yeah, you're right.
No. I mean, the people who say that are often the people who miss out on the real bump because they mistake that initial bump for the real bump. And then what happens is that you have the rocket lift off afterwards. And, you know, you could be on that rocket, Sam. The I recommend X newsletter could be, you know, $1 million a year.
Might not start a newsletter.
Well, you know, that's probably smart. You do have a staff writing job.
I mean, I do have a staff writing job, but I would like a way to harvest these little like blurps of energy, these little like creative off-gassing that happens just like every day constantly. You know, I'm like always reading stuff and thinking stuff. And that's something I've told you this. I really admire you for, you have all these different outlets and Substacks within Substacks. And it's cool and it feels fun. And you're like live stream, boring office hours and all those things. I feel like I could do something like I could like clack on my typewriter and set up a camera on what I'm typing and make people watch it. Is that how it works?
Speaking of which, how much email do you get about these pieces?
Feels like a lot to me. I actually just hired a part-time assistant to help me deal with my email. Because there's such a backlog of it. I mean, no, I think for a normal human, they would be at inbox zero without breaking a sweat. In my situation, I think I have a email disability. So I don't know, like the chips piece, I don't know, like four or five or six or seven a day or something, you know, but they're really like nice, enthusiastic emails that I want to give a really nice response to. And those are the kinds that end up getting snowed under by all the other email. And then you don't respond. And suddenly it's like a year later and you feel like a jerk.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this on a personal call we had the other day. We were saying how when someone sends you a 2,000 word essay about how your work has affected them and you're like, okay, I have to respond in kind to this or I'm a complete turd, you know, and then you don't do it and you feel worse. It's kind of this endless echo chamber of shame that just keeps building.
I have an assistant who now every day puts a little batch of emails with stars that have come in that I need to respond to. And then also makes a separate list of nice emails that people have sent me about my writing that I'm handling like basically two or three a day. And, you know, he's excavating things from like months ago and many, many months ago. And just the most, just exactly the kind of notes you're talking about. So wonderful. And so I've been starting, and it's very doable if you do them like two a day. And I've been starting a lot of emails just like, this is such a lovely email. I put it in my, you know, special response file and it just got completely avalanched by horrible other things. And I've just now excavated it. And thank you so much.
I was telling you about my strategy and you're kind of suspicious of my strategy. I know you don't like it, but I was talking to another friend who gets a lot of email. And he's written a bunch of books, and he gets a ton of correspondence. And he told me that he literally responds to every single email. And he does it not by sending a big essay back to each one. And his philosophy was that most people aren't so narcissistic or delusional that they think that you're going to respond with a 2,000-word essay to their 2,000-word essay, right? So, like, most folks kind of don't expect a response at all. And so if you just say, hey, thank you so much for taking the time to write in. I read this and I'm letting you know I read it and it means a lot to me. And, you know, I think that alone is a totally valid response. It's a great response, you know, and I think that you can preempt the expectation on the part of emailers. Like, for example, on my website, I say that I read everything, but I'm really bad at responding. And in fact, I think I've preempted it to such a degree that I'd say roughly half of all the kind of like fanish email I get finishes with, I implore you, you do not need to respond to this email. Like, don't worry about responding.
That's so great. It really is such a gift when somebody says that to you. And you respond immediately, right?
Right. Those are the only ones that you respond to because you're like, this person is so emotionally intelligent and so self-aware. It's like, I can respond to that.
Yeah. The way to get a response is to be like, at the end, be like, don't you dare respond to this, Craig. Your time is so valuable, you motherfucker. If you put one finger on your keyboard to respond to this, I will be so disappointed in you.
Yeah, no, it's like, it's exactly it. It's the sort of the anti-email gets the response. And you're like, you know, that's, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Now that I am actually responding to everybody, number one, it's a hell of a lot of work to answer your email every day. It's so much work. Like, I liked my life way better like a month ago before I had this assistant who was like staying on top of me and making sure I get to inbox zero every day. Like, it's just too much work and it's a hassle and I prefer not responding. But of course, unlike the grown-up part of me actually likes the feeling of having responded. You know, it's a kind of a pet peeve. Anyone out there listening to this podcast who's about to email me about how much they loved the podcast and when I yelled at Craig and kept interrupting him, is when people email and say, I loved what you wrote, blah, blah, blah. I would love to just hop on the phone and just like talk to you on the telephone for 15 or 20 minutes or something. And I'm like, I'm not special or famous or cool or anything, but that feels presumptuous. That feels like leaping a boundary that exists for a reason, you know? Like, I'm a text guy. I'm out there in my words, and I'll exchange some words with you, but, like, getting on the phone freaks me out.
Yeah.
You can totally get the impulse, right, which is a wonderful thing, and we've all had that thought, and I still have that thought. Like, I read a book by an author, and I think, we're best friends now. And when we meet, we will hug for 30 seconds without saying a word.
30 second wordless hug would be a little bit creepy, but you know, it's sort of a weird correspondence to get. Cause like on one hand, you're honored that someone feels so connected to you and your work that they want to, you know, hang out with you or get on the phone or whatever. And it's like, that's pretty cool. But on the other hand, you know, you feel like, there has to be a buildup. There has to be, you know, a couple emails before you breach that line.
Yeah, but I mean, that's that is like the power of writing, is that you're teleporting your consciousness into their consciousness, and it's such an intimate inside the head soul spirit connection that you can see why someone would leap over the normal social guardrails, because that's not the kind of interaction you're having when you're writing and reading. And it's kind of disappointing to imagine your favorite writers as people who just like, you know, I don't know, put their napkin on their lap before they start eating in a restaurant and then engage in small talk. Like, it kind of sucks.
So I feel hesitant to even bring this up, but I kind of feel like we have to, considering, you know, what's happened in the last couple of weeks. But like, with this new administration, creatively, psychically, is there a palpable shift you've felt in the last week or so?
Yeah, I feel lighter. I feel, yeah, like a 10% happiness boost. There's a lot. I mean, it's like there's a certain static has left the air, certain static of distraction and worry has left the air of just like the knowledge that malevolent forces have gained a lot of power and are actively finding ways to use it against goodness. I mean, that's still going on, of course. That's one of the stories of society, but they don't have as much power as they had a week ago. Yeah, it's a pretty good feeling, I would say. But then, you know, you've got, as everyone will tell you, all the giant systemic ongoing crimes are still fully in place and cranking forward. I think there were definitely, I definitely over this last year in particular have been struggling with outbursts of rage and trying to figure out what to do with that. And had an infamous work meeting where I kind of went off and shouted some things I should not have. Had an infamous jog where I stopped to confront a man with some yard signs that I probably shouldn't have done. So there, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it does feel a little bit better. Although I still feel like I feel a deep, steely, angry resolve to fight particularly the ongoing injustice of white supremacy in America, which is the volcano that keeps erupting and giving us little islands like Donald Trump, but the volcano is still down there and still belching out its magma. So that's something that writing the Oklahoma City book did to me. It radicalized me in a way I hadn't been before, because when you sit down to write about an American place, I didn't go in thinking I would write much about race. In fact, I remember some of my early trips to Oklahoma City, I remember asking various officials, like, I phrased it, how are race relations here? Such a weird thing to ask anybody. It's like such a, I don't know, PR term or something. And they were like, oh, they're great. I was like, well, that's wonderful. You know, I knew there were various tensions and I would kind of gloss over them, but the book became hugely about white supremacy and all of its institutional manifestations, and unavoidably so. I was kind of sucked into it. I grew up in Oregon, which is an extremely historically white place, and I've since learned like an aggressively white supremacist place. But to me, growing up as a little kid there, I was kind of like, oh, that's just how it is here. Like, white people occur here, just like Douglas fir trees grow here, you know? And so it took me a long time living in an American system that doesn't want to teach you otherwise, to learn like what has really gone on in this country and how this country was shaped. And what I always tell people in Oklahoma is you can't understand this place without explicitly discussing white supremacy, in the same way that you can't understand the physical world without discussing gravity. It's the same. It's shaped everything about this place. And so Oklahoma gave me that, gave me a real gift of just, and it wasn't that it was particularly Oklahoman. It was just like sitting down to write and learn about an American place as deeply as you can. You're going to, unless you're completely willfully blind to it, you're going to uncover the power of white supremacy and how much it still exists. And so I still feel like deeply radicalized about that. And I'm trying to find ways, because that's not, I didn't grow up thinking those thoughts and I didn't grow up having that as an interest. And I thought writing about and thinking about race in the United States was kind of a neat like side interest, in the same way you might study like organic chemistry or something. But it wasn't like in the main stream of literature with a capital L as I wanted to do it. All of this is like a construction of whiteness, by the way. It's like you retire into this unworldly literary realm of pure thought. And that's like just such a white fantasy. So anyway, my eyes were opened very late in my life, but I like to think of myself as a pretty, I don't know, fair-minded, justice-minded person. And so once I started reading all that and like really absorbed it, it just made me furious on very deep levels. And as a white person, it made me feel, I don't know, too many complex, contradictory emotions to describe out loud here on this podcast. And so I'm still like carrying that with me as I go. And so I think of all this, all the Trump stuff and the Biden stuff through that lens. And I'm working on some projects now where I think I get to write about all of that more explicitly and more about whiteness explicitly, which is a subject that fascinates me because whiteness is something that, you know, you and I have talked about this a lot about other things, but whiteness is a subject that is designed to be invisible in American life, to be the default setting for everything in mainstream American life. And American culture makes it for white people very easy to stay in that world and to be invisible to themselves, to not even realize what their whiteness means or what it grants them. And so, you know, that's always been what I do as a writer, is like take things that no one's looking at and make them see it, or take things that are so familiar to us that we take them for granted, and to articulate it in a way that makes it feel strange and makes you understand where it came from and how it operates in your life. It's just like what Roland Barthes does when he writes about, you know, wine, like wine versus milk or soap commercials or whatever. It's just classic cultural criticism stuff. And I want to do that with whiteness. So anyway, I've got a project I'm cooking up on that I'm excited about. So, I mean, so that's a lot. That's where a lot of my anger goes into that, and trying to, like, I don't know. There's a sense in which I proceed cheerfully, propelled by absolute rage, you know. So that's where I'm at. But it does feel less. It does feel less staticky now than it did in the Trump years.
Right. Like something's come unstuck. Like these wheels and gears that were not moving for 4 years are kind of starting to maybe move again.
Yeah. Some kind of normalcy has been reasserted. And it turns out that normalcy was incredibly important and powerful and is the platform on which we can stand to do the work that needs to be done, I think, rather than just having this malevolent force, like trying to destroy the platform itself that we can even stand on to try to begin to fix all the real huge problems that really will take all of the brain power and willpower and goodness that humanity has to solve. I mean, it's like everything is so hard. Everything is so hard. Even if everyone is acting in absolute good faith and at the edge of their abilities, it's all so hard. And you're going to come along and just start like throwing mud at people and like tripping them from behind for no reason. And just like, and then trying to enrich yourself and just, just classic human malevolence. You know, it's always been around.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my kind of feeling is this kind of sense of a breach of trust. You know, that's kind of where when I trace back my sense of anger, and I definitely also feel so much anger, especially, you know, in these last few weeks, more and more palpably. I kind of trace it back to that trust breaching, which is, you know, I think for a lot of people that goes back to childhood, that there's something kind of really atavistic about the sense of having, you know, an authority figure or whatever breaking trust. And that's something that I think from which anger flows quite naturally. And what's important is figuring out how to transmute that into something positive and something additive. And I feel like I'm able to use this engine of anger. And like when I feel slighted now, and I think the last 4 years have helped me build up this muscle. Like when I feel slighted, or I feel like there's a kind of depressive or negative force, or someone coming at me with anger or frustration or violence, I can kind of move in such a way that I take that energy coming towards me and use it for output, which I think is really important. I feel good about kind of having gotten to that place, or gotten better at getting to that place. I still don't get to it all the time.
Anger is loaded with information and energy, I think, is an Audre Lorde sentence I read recently. Anger is loaded with information and energy. So we can use it as fuel. It's good stuff.
Well, you know, you could use that energy to, you know, just perhaps do something.
Oh, are we getting to our motto, our new motto that we discovered? This Zen Cohen?
Well, I mean, we have to end on something uplifting after touching the live wire of that administration.
I do have a few mottos that I decided I wanted to hold on to in 2020 and bring into 2021. So I've got them with me. And one was from Audre Lorde, who I read in the NBA bubble. I brought a stack of books to read. I read her book, Sister Outsider, and in my hotel room. And I think this is a fairly famous sentence of hers, but it just really hit me so deep on so many levels. And it's just, your silence will not protect you. Which to me is like, you know, we've talked a lot about how I could not write forever, and I could disappear, and I could never say anything, and I could just be Mr. Distant Quiet Guy. My dad, who grew up surrounded by all kinds of dysfunction, could just disappear into silence for hours and days. It was like a deeply kind man, but that was one of the ways he, I think, dealt with things. And I have that instinct too. I can just go quiet. And so that sentence really hit me, and I think about it all the time. Your silence will not protect you. Okay, I'm like overwhelmingly anxious about writing a draft of something. What am I going to do? I remind myself, your silence will not protect you. It's not going to protect you from the anxiety of producing this draft. It's actually going to make that worse. Not saying what you know about this subject is not going to protect you from writing badly about it. Like that's not how you solve this problem either. Like that's one of my great fears, is just writing badly about things. Silence is not good. So your silence will not protect you. It won't save you from all the things you're afraid of. Silence won't do it. Not talking about Trump because you don't want to get in trouble at work or something. It's not going to protect you. Your silence will not. We've seen this with fascists throughout history. Your silence does not protect you. You know, so I hold that one close, and it applies. You know, I'm like, my wife is mad at me. I did something stupid. I whatever. There's some tension between me and a friend, whatever. Your silence will not protect you. Like silence is not the thing, like that, you know? So that to me, I mean, it's very obvious, but it's just extremely powerful. And it's so simple that I've been holding that one really close. And then the other one is kind of the other side of that coin, which is another super literary classic, which was the motto of Michel de Montaigne, the inventor of the essay in the 1500s in France, who retreated from public life to just write about what it's like to be a human being in the world. And he wrote about the most trivial things and the biggest philosophical questions. And his guiding motto, it was just, what do I know? Que sais-je in French? What do I know? And that was the beginning of everything he ever wrote, was just, what do I know about this subject? And so to me, that's the other side. So your silence will not protect you. Okay, so I have to speak. Well, what do I do now? Well, what do you know? Just say truthfully what you know about the subject. And that goes back to, you know, you're writing about a French snowball fight. All right, watch the video and say what you see. Like, what do you know about this? And that's how you just start being out in the world and putting your mind out in the world. So those are the two mottos I've been carrying around. And then this third motto that you and I have been using, which, I mean, is this a place to unveil it? Do you think your podcast audience is ready to hear this incredible life advice.
Well, if anyone is, it is them. It is the On Margins podcast listenership.
Okay, lay it on them. Tell them. Just say it. Say the sentence. Blow their minds.
All right, we gotta do a little build up. So it's like, say you got something you're supposed to be doing. You see a sock on the ground, and you're walking past it. And in your head, you think to yourself, I should put this sock wherever it belongs, because it doesn't belong on the ground. Maybe it belongs in the hamper. Maybe it's in the drawer. Maybe it's supposed to be on your foot, and you're walking by, and you're feeling that. And then you start to feel like, yeah, you know, I'll go do that a little bit later. And then you stop, and you just say out loud, you say the words, just do it.
Just do it. And then you do it. And then you just do it. You just do it. It's like the perfect summation. It's just the perfect phrase.
Well, it demands the question of, what have you been just doing, Sam?
I've been running every other day. I even ran today when it was wind chill, made it feel like 19 degrees. I just went running. You know what I said to myself? Do it, baby. Just do it. And I put on my Nike running shoes and I ran. And that is the difference between like me gaining an extra 20 pounds and me being in somewhat nice, healthy feeling shape.
Well, because this just do it philosophy came out of talking about Zadie Smith and how she's not on social media. Mm. She just sits down and decides, no Twitter, I'm going to write.
Yeah, it's inspiring and seems impossible. But that does make a nice trio of mottos, right? Your silence will not protect you.
Yep.
What do I know? And just do it.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a good year.
I think that's a cliche trio I'm down with.
Cool. Also, it's going to be a good year is the biggest cliche of all. Probably gonna suck.
Like, wait, why do we always only say that in January? We should start a trend of like April, thinking about April as the new year.
Yeah,
in Japan, April is kind of when the year starts. That's like, you know, it's sort of aligned with spring and kind of sure. The awakening of things. It makes sense. January totally. Is a weird, super weird month to think of it as being the new year. What a weird. We're in the depths of darkness. Mm-hmm. There's nothing new happening right now.
Mm-mm. Yeah, that would probably help psychologically. And I think maybe this whole COVID quarantine pandemic thing will realign our sense of when the year starts, because it's going to feel really powerful, I think, when we hit March, April, when we hit like the year anniversary of everyone going into lockdown.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of the trick is just trying to discover new exciting things along the way, even, you know, when things aren't particularly uplifting. I think last year, both you and I had a kind of an Ursula Le Guin moment.
Oh my God.
Right?
The Earthsea books. Her... Yeah. That was the best thing I read last year was like 1200 pages of Ursula K. Le Guin.
Well, and you made a nice t-shirt of her head.
Oh yeah. I'm actually wearing that right now. Weirdly under this, not on purpose, but yeah, she's peeking out. Yeah, with this incredible quote from Wizard of Earthsea, for magic consists in this, the true naming of a thing. Yeah. Again, it's just like the truth. You say the truth about a thing, and that is magic. Yeah.
That's it.
That's it. That's all it. We're doing. That's all we're doing. Just do it every day. Show up. Do it.
Yeah. I think, you know, I feel definitely a much more of a positive vibe going on today with us than I felt in March last year.
Yeah, we were working through some stuff last time, and we're still working through some stuff, but we have some new mottos, and we're moving forward. We're leaping forward rather than sort of just rolling around in a washing machine at the laundromat, and everyone is watching us through the little porthole.
Covered in lotion and water.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, man, thank you for your time and thank you for sitting in the closet once again. You sound
my
great.
Pleasure.
You look beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm working on accepting compliments, so I'm just going to believe that. I look beautiful here in the closet. You're not being sarcastic.
You look wonderful, Sam.
Thank you. It's so fun to talk with you. I really like these conversations really go deep and make me feel, I don't know, healthy. Make me feel healthy about life. So thank you.
And there you have it. Episode 2 with our buddy Sam Anderson. These things are hilariously deceptive projects to work on. These things being these podcast episodes, the amount of hours and time that goes into smoothing out and chopping this stuff up. Lord Almighty, it is a non-trivial amount of work. So if you enjoyed this, think about leaving us, I don't know, a review on iTunes. Give us some stars. I don't know, where do pods even live these days? Frankly, I have no idea how this works anymore. I would like to thank this episode's sponsor, the Sneaky View on the hike behind my house. Sneaky View, you bring lightness and joy to my life. One moment, a person is just walking through the woods, and then a little neighborhood, not expecting much. And then you turn the corner, and bam, there it is, the Sneaky View. A crazy, handsome, snow-capped Mount Fuji just sitting there in the so-called middle distance, a surrealist Mont Saint-Michel replica by way of Enoshima, and the glory of the Izu Peninsula mountain range, which I crossed last November. So thanks, Sneaky View. Nobody ever expects you, but every time I take someone on that hike, they are blown away. You make all our lives a little bit nicer.